I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Dan Hruszka. He is an assistant professor of anthropology at Arizona State University. He's the author of the book Friendship, Development, Ecology, and Evolution of a Relationship. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you study friendship, which is fascinating, and friendship varies a lot among cultures. It also varies quite a lot within our culture. How do you scientifically study something that's not so easily defined?
That's difficult. A lot of the studies of friendship that have been done have asked people how they think about their friendships, what kinds of obligations they have towards them, or how they might behave towards someone in a hypothetical scenario. And we all know that sometimes we say different things than we actually do. So one of the important parts of the study of friendship today is using behavioral experiments to understand how when you manipulate small aspects of the situation, like will the friend find out what you did after you do it, or do you know that the friend did something for you in the past, how that changes people's behaviors towards each other.
And so you have found out things like, for example, if you have the opportunity to do something for a friend, even if that friend never knows that it was you, you're a lot more likely to do it than you are to do that same kind thing or helpful thing for an acquaintance or a stranger.
That's absolutely right. And so we find this increased generosity, increased cooperation, increased helping and sharing among friends occurs even when you take away something called the shadow of the future, the concern about your reputation or the concern about what your friend would think of you after you've done something.
The impression that I get from your book, and not being an anthropologist myself or knowing the literature all that well, but there seems to be a movement in your field from a kind of view of human beings as essentially selfish to a view of human beings that's more really willing to empathize and help each other out. Is that, what do you think?
I think for a long time, anthropology has based on, I think, good ethnographic case studies, has realized that people do things to help each other for the good of that person. I might say in economics and other disciplines, that realization has only come to the forefront in the last 20 or 30 years. What anthropology is doing today, and also you see in economics and other social sciences, is the use of behavioral experiments and other types of scientific techniques to test these realizations we have from the ethnographic record.
Now, what are the features of friendship that are consistent across cultures?
So, that's a really good question. There are some subtle differences that we see that I think are good to emphasize that violate our own ideas about friendship. So, for example, in many societies you'll find that friendships are arranged in the same way that you might find arranged marriages in South Asia or other parts of the world where parents get together and say, you guys need to be friends, and it's very hard not to be friends. And sometimes these are even ritually sanctified in the same way you might see a marriage ceremony in front of a public audience. People vow to be friends forever to each other. So this is something that kind of violates our own ideas about how friendships are voluntary and just between two people. So there are some subtle differences between societies, but generally at the core of friendship, as you see it in different places and times, is people form close, cooperative relationships with people where you're supposed to help them in times of need, and you help them because you're concerned about their goodwill, not because you're concerned about some future payoff or what they did for you directly in the past.
So scientists tend to look at the adaptive significance or evolutionary significance of every possible kind of behavior, and including friendship. And it's interesting that the way you're looking at friendship, you're not coming up with the idea that, okay, I do this for you and then you'll do that for me. It's a much looser structure, even in our society, which is so capitalistic and so based on very tight economic transactions.
Right, and that's interesting. There's a tension here between the algorithms, the decision rules that people use to help friends, which it turns out don't follow these strict accounting guidelines. But at the same time, it turns out that having friends can be very adaptive. So over the long run, cultivating relationships with people where you both have this automatic knee-jerk response to help each other can be quite adaptive in the long run, even though our immediate decision-making algorithm doesn't actually make us decide that way.
What are some features of friendship that are specifically American or maybe European?
Well, like I mentioned, we have a strong view that friendship should be voluntary. We should be able to break up our friendships when we want. In some societies where you have these public rituals, you'll find that it's actually quite difficult to divorce your friend. You have to go through another ceremony, essentially, to break up the friendship. So this notion of voluntariness, I think, is very unique in some ways to the United States and the West. We also tend to say that we shouldn't loan money to friends, and that friends should be somehow divorced from our material lives and material exchanges, whereas in Bangladesh, where I work, or other parts of the world, giving and helping monetarily is actually a crucial part of having a friendship.
You work in Bangladesh. What do you see, maybe from your own life as well as what you study, in terms of friendships that happen across cultures? Are they the same as other friendships?
Well, I only have a limited sample size for that. I could say that the inchoate friendships that I've started forming in my own work in Bangladesh. I think that we do have to negotiate some of these different ideas about, for example, to what degree does material exchange and help figure importantly in friendship? To what degree does disclosing the most intimate details of our lives figure into friendship? In the United States, I think there's this idea that very close friends should disclose a great deal of their personal lives to their friends, whereas in other societies, you may not see such intimate disclosure. And so I think the challenge of cross-cultural friendship is finding out those small points of difference, which sometimes can be quite invisible to us and frustrating, and then working with those.
You write about the similarities and differences between friendships outside of families and then the kind of kinship relationships that we have within families and extended families. And I've been thinking a lot about friendship because I was just out of town for a couple of weeks, and I saw an old dear friend who was actually a very close friend of my father's, who passed away many years ago, and he is an Englishman who is and has been for many decades married to an Italian woman, and after their children were grown, he came to a realization, which is that he had friends and she had family, and although those two things, it played some of the same roles, in other words, the kind of relationships that his wife had with her family and the kind of relationships that he had with his friends maybe filled in some of the same needs and joys in life, it made them very different people, and it kind of was a Northern and Southern European thing. And I wondered if you could comment on that kind of difference.
Yeah, it's we oftentimes divide our lives into kin and into friends. And that's the way we make sense of the world. It's sometimes difficult, actually, to make that distinction. In the book, I talk about how the word for friend in Iceland is vinar, and I'm probably pronouncing it incorrectly, and the word for relations is friend. So at some point, the word for friend transformed into becoming the word for kin, meaning that these categories at some point historically oftentimes flip-flop back and forth between each other. In Bangladesh, where I work, people can have friends. They're people that they're closely emotionally attached to, who they help in times of need, but they probably would refer to them as Baha'i, which is brother. And so they use kin terms to apply to relationships which are really friendships. So there's a lot of back and forth between what counts as kin and what counts as friends, partly because they're so similar in terms of the kinds of support they provide. So when someone says, my life is based on kin, it's important to ask, well, how much of that is biological kin or affinal kin through marriage, or people who I've come to love in my life and get support from, and I think of them as kin, but in fact, they may not have any direct kin relationship to me.
We're talking to Dan Hruszka, professor of anthropology and author of the book Friendship, Development, Ecology, and Evolution of a Relationship. Sometimes, I mean, we were talking about the sort of non-tit-for-tat nature of friendship. So you have a friend where you're really not keeping track of the give and take and who did what for whom and all of that. And one way I was thinking about that in my own life is sometimes my friends and I, we take each other out for dinner or for lunch, and we can never remember who took whom out last. And we just seem to let go of those kinds of things. But sometimes when a friendship becomes really imbalanced, it can weaken or end altogether. So how do you understand those breaking points?
That's a very interesting topic for exploration, and we know very little about it. So we know that with current experimental designs, we're unable to identify these concerns about tit-for-tat or these concerns about the shadow of the future that I described earlier. But at some point, people must be keeping track somehow, maybe through their emotions. Emotions maybe are a long-term integration of your past memories of a person. Maybe people focus on the length of the relationship. There's still a lot of work to be done on how people make these decisions over the long run. At what point does it become too imbalanced and you decide enough is enough? That I think there aren't really good answers to yet, and it's an area for open exploration.
There's another thing that's very interesting, and that is that I think, at least in our society, we have an expectation of most friendships, maybe not all, but most, that equality is a central feature of that friendship. And I was thinking, how common or uncommon is equality in, for example, primate societies like chimps or monkeys, who are our close relatives, and maybe have their own friendship patterns as well?
That's a good question. I know a lot less about the non-human primate literature. What I can say is that among at least chimpanzees, you do find relationships among males who are not related by kin, biological kinship, but they're cooperative, they form alliances, and they do seem to be relatively equal. That said, there is a lot of hierarchy in both human societies and non-human primate societies. So it may be difficult for any relationship not to have some sort of taint or hue of hierarchy in it. In humans, we do find friendships that have hierarchy, where the people are not equal. One example of this are very intimate teacher-student relationships you find in parts of South Asia and East Asia, where over the long course of a mentorship, you might say that a friendship forms in terms of the key features of a close, emotionally attached relationship where people help each other in times of need. But there's still a lot of inequality there in terms of the social standing of the partners.
There's also, for example, I mean, in any city like Santa Fe, somebody might come from another country and be poor and make friends with a family who is a middle-class family that helps them out, and they really become friends. And sometimes those are very strong friendships between, let's say, an immigrant and a citizen of a place. And those are very interesting to me because they have their own kind of, I don't know, their own features and their own way of playing out.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tension there between the fact that we're supposed to help each other, share each other, treat each other as human beings, and at the same time, there is this hierarchy and there's this status inequality there. That can be a real tension in relationships.
It seems to me also that there are so many kinds of friends. Some friends are based on kind of shared activities that you like to do. Some are based on really liking to talk to each other. There's such a huge variation. Some are really seem not to be based on being there for each other when times are hard.
That's a really good point. And one of my studies in grad school was focused on what are the kinds of things people want to get out of their friendships. And it turns out, and these were adolescents in the United States, it turns out there's a great deal of diversity between people in terms of the kinds of things they most value in their friends. One thing that's interesting there is people who care more about having friends who are fun to be around and exciting rather than someone they can disclose personal details with or someone who's going to be there in times of need. Those people tend to become friends. And those people who care more about having friends who will be there for them in times of need tend to become friends. Now, that's just differences between people. I think we also find that in our own lives, my own life, for example, and your own life, we probably have several different people that serve, you might say, different functions. That's a very callous way of saying it, but who serve different functions for us in terms of someone who's really funny and exciting to be around, but in fact might not really be very reliable in terms of helping you when you need it. Or someone else who may be really reliable and supportive, but ultimately is not the most fun person to be with at a bar. And so we oftentimes in our own lives make these choices where we have maybe a diverse portfolio of friendships. That said, I want to make sure that we're talking about this, that's a very callous way of painting it and a very economic way of painting it. And the way we do this usually is not as callous or economic as I've just described it.
No, and it's so contextual. I mean, my father, for example, was a person who had a lot of friends. And then when he developed a terminal illness, some people turned out to be really true friends, and some people dropped off the earth altogether.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it makes you, those times of difficulty make you redefine what friendship is.
That's absolutely right. And, like they say, friendship really, you find who your friends are when there's a time of need. In our society in the United States, we have fewer times of great need than you might say someone does in Bangladesh or other societies where people face chronic food insecurity, where an illness can wipe you out if there's no health insurance. In those places, I think you see more very strong demonstrations of friendship in a way you don't see in the United States as much. You don't just have the opportunity to see that. This also paints, I think, a picture of how tenuous friendship can be and why it's never certain who a real friend is. And that's one of the challenges in forming human relationships is over the course of a lifetime identifying those people who will be reliable and those who won't.
Is that something that you've also looked at? In other words, what goes into making a really strong long-term friendship?
Well, one of the strongest indicators is how long you've known the person. If we talk about this is someone I've known since grade school or someone I've known since high school, and that gives a lot of import and value to the relationship. The assumption is that over that course of many, many years that there's been lots of opportunities to help each other when you needed it. So that's one way that strong friendships get formed is just the sheer length of the relationship. Another thing that seems to make stronger relationships are being in situations of great need together. So you find very strong friendships coming out of being in war together or being in prison together. So places where you really needed someone when you were in a place of great need.
Because when you've been through that together, you already know that you can rely on them.
Yes, yeah.
Now, you make a distinction in the book between the dynamics of a friendship and the dynamics of a romantic relationship. I've also noticed that there is some kind of funny overlap where you meet somebody, and although it's not a sexual or even really overtly romantic thing, you fall in love with somebody, and you just love being around them, and that relationship often, even though it's just a quote-unquote just a friendship, it has a life cycle the way the other kind of relationship, the way a sexual or erotic relationship has a life cycle.
And there's been some very interesting work done by psychologists. Lisa Diamond is one of the people who have tried to dissect the different types of feelings and motivations we can have towards our partners. And it turns out there's the sexual drive, where we care about having sex with an individual. The other is this romantic infatuation, which, as you just described, can be completely divorced from any sexual drive. And then there is, on top of that, or can be orthogonal to it, is this benevolent concern for a person where you want to help them when they need it. It's very possible to have a romantic infatuation with someone that's very selfish, meaning all I care about is being next to this person and all I care about is making sure that that person spends most of their time with me and attends to me. That can be not benevolent at all. And so what she's done, and Helen Fisher's done good work on this too, is showing that these really can be three completely different emotional and motivational systems that sometimes come together, but sometimes are you only see one of them in any one relationship.
What are some of the differences between the way women have friends and men have friends?
That is a long-standing question, and there are many stereotypes in the United States about how men and women form friends, stereotypes that have changed over the last 100 years. So, for example, there was an evolutionary analysis that came out in the 1960s that argued that based on our evolutionary past, men should be much better at making friends than women should, and then they used data to support that. More recently, the exact opposite argument's been made based on evolutionary theory, that women should be better at men than making friends. And they've found data to support that. But what it turns out is when you look at the objective data, most variation you see in how people disclose information to each other, how much they help friends versus strangers, what they do for each other, how often they interact with each other, most of that variation is within the sexes. So even though you might find some small statistical difference between the mean for men and women, most of the variation is within men and within women.
It turns out that some women are better at making friends and some men are better at making friends, and it's really not about gender at all.
Right, exactly. And some men disclose a great deal to their male friends, and some men don't. Some women do, and some women don't.
What about friendships between men and women? Are they less common?
In the cross-cultural record, they're much less common, especially in societies where it's difficult for non-kin men and women to have any kind of relationship because there's concerns about cuckoldry or adultery. You'll find that in certain, especially Muslim societies, South Asian societies, it's harder for, in traditional societies, it's harder for men and women to be friends until maybe they've gone past the reproductive age. So once they get much older, they could be friends. But there's a concern before then that it might lead to a heterosexual relationship.
Are there differences in the people's ability to form friendship based on their age? In other words, is it harder to make friends, close friends, as you get older?
The available literature on that suggests it has less to do with your age than with the situation you're in. And so people have a much stronger motivation to form friends, and thus it's easier for them if they've just moved to a new place where they don't have any friends. And the friends that are made are oftentimes people who have also just moved to the place because the people who are already there already have their set of friends. So the situation that you're in, I think, determines whether it's easy to make friends more than actually your age.
What about false friends? You quote from literature of different societies and completely different East Asian and American, European, but it seems like every society has warnings against people who seem like your friends, but they're not.
Well, for precisely the reason that you mentioned before about only in a time of need do you actually find out who your true friends are, people are fixated on this issue of how do you identify who a false friend is. And it's very difficult. And so there's been a lot written on it to try to give some guidance as to who is a false friend or not. But ultimately, all that guidance usually boils down to you'll really only find out once the person has been put in a situation where they need to help you in times of need.
Now, I have to ask this because of the society we're living in, but what about online friends? Is that something that is being studied? I don't just mean Facebook friends, but for example, I have a very good friend who is a musician and plays a kind of very specific music that is shared by a small international subculture. And he told me once that some of his best friends are people he's never met because they share so much of their life's passion online.
Yeah, I think online media is fundamentally changing how people are forming friends. There's been a lot of debate about how it's fundamentally changing friendships. Some people say it's weakening them. Some people say it's permitting them to form relationships with people with very sort of fine-grained common interests, like the one you just described, in ways they couldn't before. Also, some people have argued that it allows people to really reveal themselves to other people in a way that they wouldn't have felt comfortable doing before, because now you can be online and only reveal very certain aspects of your identity before you even meet, in a way that normally when you come in contact with a person face-to-face, you see their gender, you see their race, you see all these things that layer your perception of them before you can actually form the relationship. So people have proposed several different ways that online mediation might change the way we form friends. And another way that it's permitting people to maintain relationships is that you might have a very close friend who you haven't seen for a very long time, and now with this online mediation, it permits you to keep track of them much more regularly than you would have before. So there's a large literature forming now about what online mediation is going to do for friendships in the future.
There's another aspect to that too, I think, which is that when you make a friend within that subculture who lives somewhere else, they're not going to talk to about you behind your back to somebody else in that community, because that you don't live in the same community. And so there is a kind of one-on-one that is in some way a little safer.
Right. And they may actually talk to someone about you, but it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, exactly.
So they may find there's a funny story that you told them, and it's a personal story, but because the people they tell it to will never actually know who you are, it doesn't matter. Yeah, I think that's another aspect of the online communication which could change how friendships form.
Friendship is such a fundamentally humanistic thing, and here you are studying it with the tools of science. Do you also look to literature and to places where it's been explored in a more humanistic way and perhaps a more profound way to understand in your work what you're doing?
Definitely. And I consider philosophical works on friendship, there have been many discussions of this throughout the last two millennia in different cultures. Those are great documents describing how people in different societies have talked about friendships and have discussed them. And what are the main tensions in friendship? What are the dilemmas faced by friends? And so I find the philosophical and humanistic literature very useful for considering some of these issues.
Dan Hruszka is an assistant professor of anthropology at Arizona State University. He's author of the book Friendship, Development, Ecology, and Evolution of a Relationship. Dan, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.